Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young, It's Here and Now. The special prosecutor investigating the leak of the identity of undercover CIA agent Valerie Plame is expected to post indictments on his website at any moment now. Presidential adviser Karl Rove's lawyers have said that he has escaped indictment, at least for now, but the vice president's chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, will reportedly be charged. Later this afternoon, special prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald is to hold a news conference to talk about the charges and the nearly two-year investigation into the leak. At that time, Fitzgerald is expected to say whether he will seek to extend the current grand jury or establish a new one to investigate further charges against Karl Rove. Rove has been under renewed scrutiny for failing to tell the grand jury that he spoke with a reporter about Plame, whose husband is a prominent administration critic. And Libby has told the grand jury that he heard about Plame from reporters when his notes indicate he heard about her from the vice president. Well, joining us on the line now to go over the details is Judy Keene. She covers Washington for USA Today. And Judy, are you on the website now? Are you looking at it?
Yes, I'm monitoring the website and also looking at the Associated Press wire. It doesn't appear that we have the announcements yet, but in fact, they were supposed to be made right at noon.
Okay, well, our listeners, by the way, can go to our website, here-now.org, and you can get onto Patrick Fitzgerald's website as well. I'm on it, and there's nothing been posted yet, but what is expected to happen, Judy?
Associates of Scooter Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, have confirmed to me on background that he's been notified that he should expect to be indicted today. Karl Rove's lawyer, Robert Luskin, has issued a statement saying that Rove has been notified that he will not be charged with any crime at this time, as you reported a minute ago, but that no final decision has been made and that the investigation will continue. That's news, too, because we all thought that today, the day that the grand jury term expires, would mark the end of this case. That's obviously not going to happen.
By the way, Judy, we'll talk more about this with people who haven't been in the position of being special prosecutors, but what does that mean? Do they have to start a new grand jury if they extend the investigation?
We're not certain about that. Yesterday, Mr. Fitzgerald's spokesman declined to confirm for us whether this grand jury had previously been extended, which would seem to preclude it from being extended again. They weren't willing to talk about that. There are reports that it cannot be expired, and therefore he would have to seat another. I think we'll learn more about that at 2 o'clock this afternoon when Mr. Fitzgerald has his news conference.
And Judy, sit tight there and look at the website for a second while I introduce Julian Zelitzer. He's here with us in the studio, as he's been before, a professor of history at Boston University. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And I just want to comment, Judy. Julian and I have been sitting here, and you as well may have some television station images there.
Oh, yes.
And there was one that was pretty, Frank, you saw a huge full-screen shot of what appeared to be the president taking off for Camp David. He's expected to be going there today. And all around the screen were the written messages about the CIA documents that are expected to come out. Julian, that was a pretty stark image.
Yeah, it reminded me actually of when Bill Clinton, when the impeachment hearings were going on, and you saw half a screen on the impeachment and half a screen on the bombing in Iraq. And it was the juxtaposition of a president trying to act as a president, and on the other hand, this other story we all know is looming about investigation, scandal, and corruption.
Well, Julian's going to continue to put this story in perspective for us today. But Judy, what's being said in Washington? I mean, obviously, this is nerves have been on edge. We've been reporting on that for weeks. But how big a day is this?
This is a huge day. The White House has been worrying about this literally for months, almost for 2 years now. And for the last few days, top officials there, amazingly unaware themselves of what's going to happen, have been asking reporters to share with them, what are you hearing? Some very senior advisors to the president have asked me that question. I think we can get a glimpse into the president's mood. He went this morning to Norfolk, Virginia, to make a speech about the war on terror. And at the beginning of his remarks to his audience there, he said, thanks for the chance to get out of Washington.
All right. We heard that in our introduction today. Judy, you keep watching the website for us. We want to bring Rich Strasburg in. He's a former federal prosecutor who worked with Patrick Fitzgerald in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan. He's also familiar with high-profile political trials. He worked on the Martha Stewart trial, and he's now a partner with Goodwin Procter. Richard, your thoughts on, well, the documents, first of all, that are coming out and what we've heard about what may or may not happen.
Well, it's interesting. The reports, as Judy was just mentioning, suggest that there is going to be an indictment today. I think that the statement from Rove's attorney that suggests that the grand jury will be continuing its investigation suggests that there's still a substantial amount of pressure and likely some negotiations that are going on between all the parties and the prosecutor about what the ultimate outcome is going to be here.
Well, we've been hearing in the last couple of days of a flurry of activity of Karl Rove's lawyers visiting the prosecutor visiting the judge. Is there such a thing as a deal in a case like this, a last-minute deal?
Always a possibility. As charges are about to be filed, certainly in the days leading up to today, there would be enormous pressure on the individuals involved to try to reach a deal, a compromise, because at the end of the day, since this is a criminal trial, if the individuals are indicted and are convicted, they're looking at prison time. That's a pretty strong motivator to try to reach a deal to avoid that.
Well, not only that, Judy, as others have said, if there is a criminal trial, the White House is looking at someone on the stand testifying about what possible conversations might have been in the White House about this name and further about the intelligence that is behind this story, the we now know faulty intelligence about weapons of mass destruction. That could all be on a stand.
If, as we expect, the vice president's chief of staff is indicted, I think that there's a very real possibility that the vice president himself would be required to testify in a trial. This is going to occupy Washington for months to come. It seems to be a given that Mr. Libby will resign if indeed he is indicted today, but the fact that Mr. Rove remains under a cloud and that this investigator is not finished with his business means this will continue to be a distraction for months to come at a time when this president also faces now a decision about a new Supreme Court nominee.
And Julian Zelitzer, this seems familiar too.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways what presidents want when they're in this situation is for the uncertainty to end so they can react. If Libby's indicted, they know what they're dealing with. In some ways, the worst outcome is for this to continue. Both now you'll have a trial and Rove is still under investigation. It's hard for the administration to respond at that point.
Right.
And they're just in limbo. They're in limbo with an air of corruption.
Rich Strasburg, again, a former federal prosecutor and has worked on high-profile trials. How wide might this net go? I mean, Mr. Rove and Mr. Libby's names are being mentioned today, but there's also been concern that the National Security Council, for instance, might be roped in, and we just have mentioned Dick Cheney's name.
Well, I think that Pat Fitzgerald is a very, very thorough and meticulous prosecutor, and he's likely to look far and wide for evidence that might support whatever charges it is that he would be bringing. So I think it's potentially very, very expansive, even if the charge itself is a relatively narrow charge of false statement or perjury.
And Rich Strasburg, again, we've been saying that that while Karl Rove is not expected to be charged with anything today, that he has reportedly been told that he might still be under investigation, which means starting another process. How does that work? Remind us, what is a grand jury? How many people are in it? Who are they? And how do you start another one?
Well, the grand jury is typically a body of 23 people chosen from the community, and they have to agree with a total of 16 people to vote for an indictment to be filed. They hear evidence that the prosecutor puts before them, but it's not like a trial. There's no judge. It's only one-sided. The defense doesn't have a right to go before the grand jury and put in its own version of what the facts are. And the grand jury has a relatively low standard. It is a standard of probable cause to believe that there's been a crime, but that's the basis on which an indictment can be filed. In this instance, all the talk has been, will the grand jury expire or not? But in the normal course of doing investigations, especially complicated type investigations that involve interviewing many people, it's very common to have the grand juries extended. That typically is done by an application to the judge asking for a six-month extension of the grand jury's time.
And Judy Keen, who again is covers Washington for USA Today and is now covering the Patrick Fitzgerald, the special counsel's website for us. We have it up here on our computers as well. There's supposed to be documents released within this hour at 12 noon. They have not yet appeared. There's also going to be a press conference at 2 o'clock East Coast time. Patrick Fitzgerald is expected to announce publicly his findings at that time. But Judy, one thing, and this is an opportunity to ask it, one thing puzzles many of us, to remind ourselves, Mr. Rove had said that it was Robert Novak, the columnist, who told him that Joseph Wilson's wife was an agent. Novak wrote that two administration officials told him. We never hear Robert Novak's name. Might we hear anything today? I mean, he was the first and, you know, in that moment, the only reporter to write the leaked name. Might we hear what he told the grand jury?
Well, one of the great remaining unanswered questions about this, and there are many, but one of the significant ones is who was Novak's initial source? We know that he spoke with Rove. The characterizations that we've read and heard about it are that Novak said he had already heard this information and that Rove said something like, I've heard that too. The big question is, who is Novak's initial source? Unlike other reporters who were spoken to about this by administration officials, we know very little about Mr. Novak and his relationship with Fitzgerald. It's safe to assume, I think, that he has testified or cooperated in some way because he never faced the threat of jail time as others did. We don't know who his initial source was, and maybe we'll find that out today.
We should say that earlier this week, I believe it was the Washington Post that reported that Robert Novak had told his sources to the grand jury, but again, we don't know until we hear more. Julian?
I mean, I think the other elephant in the room here is Congress, and we haven't heard much from them. Unlike the Watergate and Clinton, Congress has not yet been involved, and I think after these indictments happen, there's going to be pressure, certainly from Democrats, even from some Republicans, for possible congressional investigations, not into this story, but into the bigger part of what this is related to, the war in Iraq and the buildup. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's kind of the next step in this story, which would be very hard for the administration, public hearings on television about what this is all about. What is this really leading back to?
Well, and Rich Strasburg, how difficult is it legally to extend and expand this?
Again, usually it is a matter of routine to extend a grand jury if you believe there are more things that need to be done. The prosecutor would make an application to the court where the grand jury is sitting, and if the prosecutor says, I need more time to do more investigation, it's very, very typical that that time is granted and the grand jury is extended.
That's Rich Strasburg, a former federal prosecutor. He also worked on the Martha Stewart trial, so he's familiar with these high-profile cases. We've also got, let's do a roundup here, Judy Keen, who covers Washington for USA Today. Judy has been monitoring Patrick Fitzgerald's website, which you can get to at our website, here-now.org. Anything yet on the website, Judy?
Not yet. We're still waiting. It's hard to infer what this delay might mean. Perhaps nothing.
Okay. And, they're probably aware that many people are sitting staring at their computers waiting to hear. But this prosecutor has not seemed rushed by any kind of public pressure, has he?
He has not, and I think that should he bring charges today on perjury or false statements and not on the underlying charge of whether officials broke the federal law barring the knowing disclosure of the identity of an undercover CIA agent, and if this investigation, which has already gone on for 20 months and cost something nearing $1 million, I think that there'll start to be pressure on him and perhaps criticism as well, that he's embarked on some sort of endless fishing expedition. Knowing how Washington works and having covered the Clinton-Lewinsky matter for USA Today, it almost feels like that will be an inevitable part of the next political dialogue here.
That's Judy Keene for USA Today. Rich Strasburg, former federal prosecutor, thanks for weighing in with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Julian Zelitzer, professor of history at Boston University, is going to stay with us to put all of this in perspective. And we hope you do, too. We'll keep our eye on this website. Go to our website, here-now.org, if you'd like to join along. Stay with us much more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're continuing our conversation about the pending indictments expected today against the vice president's chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby. The president's closest advisor, Karl Rove, has apparently escaped indictment for now, according to reports. But the grand jury is reportedly looking to continue to investigate possible charges against Rove as well. The special prosecutor in the nearly two-year-long investigation will outline the charges later this afternoon. We've been monitoring Patrick Fitzgerald's website, where he was said to post documents at 12 noon East Coast time today. We still don't see anything on that website, but we'll keep an eye on it for you. And if you'd like to go there, go to our website, here-now.org. And we're joined now by John Mercurio, senior editor of The Hotline, the daily political briefing of the National Journal. John, we know how Washington can be. Is this what everybody is talking about?
Oh, gosh, absolutely. I mean, every, you know, Capitol, every sort of congressional office that I've called today, I was up on the Hill earlier this morning. I mean, everybody's sort of glued to their televisions. This is when cable news really rules the roost because they're the only ones providing, you know, sort of constant constant news on this source, other than radio, of course. and it's a culture of Washington that we're all sort of, you know, in some ways buzzing about something which obviously has such a dark, dark connotation.
And we've got Julian Zelitzer with us as well, a professor of history at Boston University. And Julian, you've been sort of weighing how this, I mean, it's all speculative right now, but there's been a drumbeat of several months and how this feels compared to other times like this.
It feels pretty bad. I mean, I've been, you know, you think of the context and the fact that you have the Tom DeLay and Bill Frist story happening at the same time makes it a little different than previous scandals that we've gone through. Every branch of government under the control of the same party has pretty potentially devastating individual stories of investigation.
We should remind ourselves, Tom DeLay facing charges in Texas, Bill Frist facing charges that he had done things unethically with some family funds. And both of them, and Tom DeLay in particular, I should stick with Tom DeLay in particular, has said that what we're seeing is a criminalization of conservatism, that this is a piling on. And with that in mind, I'd like to turn to Whit Ayers, Republican pollster. Whit, we're so thankful that you're joining us. The last time we spoke to you, I think I read a sort of a litany of some of these, you know, not great stories that are happening for the Republicans. And at the time you said you wanted to put pins in your eyes or something like that.
I believe it was slit my wrist. <Same difference.
laughs> How are you feeling today, Whit, watching what's unfolding?
Well, bad news tends to come in bunches, and it just tends to keep coming on in recent weeks. It really is a struggle to maintain any sense of proportion or perspective when these kinds of stories continue a drumbeat. It might help us to remember that the last president who was battling scandal stories in his second term was Bill Clinton. And in the 1998 election, his party actually gained 5 seats in the House of Representatives. So that helps us remember that voters tend to place a far higher priority on the things that directly affect their lives,
Julian,
the state of the economy, the gas prices in Iraq, and that sort of thing, than they do on these kinds of stories that consume so much time and energy in Washington.
I think Julie wants to jump in there.
I mean, I think the point's a good one, but that actually raises the difference with Clinton. Clinton was going through this when the economy was strong. Clinton was going through this when we weren't in the same kind of a war, and Clinton's polls were phenomenally strong throughout this. And I think that makes it that much more problematic for the Bush administration, not the scandal itself, but the context in which he's trying to deal with this.
But the point, the fundamental point, though, is that voters tend to care a lot about things that affect their lives and a lot less about things that are, by all accounts, an incredibly complex and complicated story. And we don't even have any idea here whether there's going to be an indictment for actually outing a CIA agent, which is what this whole investigation has been about for the last 2 years.
John Mercurio, jump in. Yep, jump in there.
Wait, hey, it's John Mercurio.
Hey, John.
You would know this much better than I would, but what is your polling showing? I mean, the polls that I've seen have shown that in states, specifically a state like Virginia, where there's a gubernatorial race in less than 2 weeks, these stories have actually depressed the Republican base, as opposed to 1998, when you saw that the investigation into President Clinton actually motivated the Democratic base.
Well, we'll find out, I guess, on November the 8th in Virginia and in New Jersey. But what if you ask people the most important issues facing the country, these kinds of stories don't scratch the top of the list. It's things that affect people's lives directly.
Well, let me ask you that, Whit, because some would say that this story isn't about the leaking of a CIA name, as bad as that may be. It's about the reasons for going to war. And there are now over 2,000 dead American U.S. Service people in Iraq. Doesn't that affect Americans' lives? And doesn't that reach to the heartbeat and the base of President Bush?
Well, what happens in Iraq most definitely affects people's lives and most definitely affects people's assessments of this administration and the how wise the policy was in the Middle East. The key about Iraq is whether or not those 2,000 deaths have been worth it or whether they have been in vain. We won't know that yet. But if we end up creating a stable democracy in the most volatile region of the world, the decision to go into Iraq will look quite wise in retrospect.
Well,
we just don't know that.
Professor Zelitzer, I want you to have the last word on this. We've got about a minute and a half. You know, will what Witt says and hopes, I know he's a pollster, to be true if, in fact, we are there based on an effort to get false information, false intelligence out to the American people?
No, I mean, I think he's being a little more optimistic than I would be in reading where this can go. And I would just add that when conditions are bad, these kinds of stories, as complicated as they can be, become a way in which Americans think of what their president is about. So even if they don't understand the details, and even if this isn't something that affects their lives, it becomes a way of judging a president who seems unable to control events.
That's Julian Zelitzer, a professor at Boston University. We've also been speaking with Witt Ayers, a Republican pollster. Witt, we so appreciate your coming on the program. We hope we speak to you again next week. Let's see what your polls do show.
Okay.
And John Mercurio, senior editor of The Hotline, the daily political briefing of the National Journal. John, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And again, if you'd like to go to Patrick Fitzgerald's, the special counsel's website, go to ours, here-now.org. He is supposed to be putting documents within this hour on the website, and at 2 o'clock East Coast time, holding a press conference to detail exactly what charges he'll be making after months of investigation and whether or not he'll continue the investigation into the outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ron Bersani is celebrating a bittersweet victory. Bersani, a 59-year-old grandfather from Marshfield, Massachusetts, will be at the State House in Boston later when Governor Mitt Romney signs Melanie's Law. That law is named for Ron's granddaughter, Melanie. She was 13 years old when she was killed by a repeat offender drunk driver 2 years ago. Bersani and others hope the law will make it more difficult for repeat offenders, such as the one who killed his granddaughter, to get back behind the wheel. He joins us now. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Robin.
And listeners here in the Boston area know what a personal crusade this has been for you, but remind those outside the area, what happened to Melanie?
Melanie was at a birthday party, and Marshfield is a beach community. Melanie was at the beach with eight of her friends, and they were leaving the beach to go to the birthday girl's house for cake and ice cream and presents. They're all very excited. And as they were crossing the street, Melanie was struck and killed by a repeat offense drunk driver. She was thrown 100 feet. The driver was going 45 to 50 miles an hour. Melanie never had a chance, and she died the next day.
Mm. The woman who killed Melanie, as you said, was a repeat offender. You gathered statistics and began lobbying for your legislation, and you learned that 20% of everyone arrested for driving under the influence are repeat offenders.
It's a huge problem. You know, there are many people who are arrested once, and it's the worst experience of their life, and they will go through assessment and treatment, and they will learn from a terrible mistake and recognize the consequences if they continue to do that. Unfortunately, there are those who get behind the wheel again and again and again. MAD, for instance, estimates that for every one time a person is stopped for drunk driving, they may have driven as many as 1 to 200 times.
MAD is, of course, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And one would think that that information would easily lead to legislation. But what did you run up against in our legislature?
Well, in Massachusetts, we have one of the worst records in the country relative to drunk driving. We were the last state in the nation to pass the per se law. We are just far, far behind the national curve.
What's that, the per se law?
The per se law says that if you are stopped for drunk driving, if you take a breathalyzer test, if your blood alcohol level is 0.08 or higher, that is enough to prove that you are, in fact, impaired. You are operating under the influence. We were the last state in the nation to make that a law.
And you were looking for legislation that would take past offenses into consideration. There was a lot of opposition to that, some suspicion that many of the lawmakers were themselves at one time attorneys for drunk drivers.
Well, and that's true. In the Massachusetts legislature, there are 200 members in the legislature. 55 are attorneys. Now, not all of them are criminal defense attorneys, but there are some criminal defense attorneys in the legislature, particularly in the House, who have very powerful positions in the House, and we ran into some very stiff opposition.
Well, Ron, let me ask you, though, to play devil's advocate. In many criminal cases, a person's past cannot be taken into consideration. You know, you're only supposed to be tried once for a crime. Isn't there something to be said for being able to get a fresh start if you were tried once for something or if you were judged once on something? That should not be applied to a new case.
Well, I think with drunk driving, the problem is that it's the habitual offender, the people who continually get behind the wheel and drive drunk, that are absolutely the biggest problem we have on the road today. And in Massachusetts, it was extremely difficult to prove prior convictions under the old rules.
Well, and so you proposed new legislation. It was watered down by lawmakers, which outraged people. But further, there's another backstory here. Many of those lawmakers then went on a vacation to Portugal. They were pictured sunning themselves, and the outrage only increased. And now Governor Mitt Romney has stepped in and toughened up the laws again, and those are the laws that are going to be signed today. What do they say about repeat offenders?
Well, for one thing, it allows the introduction of certified court documents at the sentencing portion of a trial, and that just means after someone has been convicted of drunk driving, the prosecution is allowed to introduce certified court documents that this is not the first offense for drunk driving, and with each subsequent drunk driving conviction, you are eligible for stiffer penalties. In the past, the Commonwealth would actually have to bring the arresting officer or a clerk of court from a prior trial back to get up on the stand and under oath say, yes, that's the person that was arrested 2 years ago in my community for drunk driving.
Yeah. And now the new legislation mandates a one-year suspension for young drivers or people who have been convicted, a five-year suspension for those with two prior convictions, and a lifetime suspension for those with three or more prior convictions?
That is correct, and what we have found in other states and the research that I've done and that Mothers Against Drunk Driving has done is that stiffer penalties save lives, and they do reduce the percentage of people who will die in accidents that can be blamed on drunk driving.
The new law is tough, but it doesn't have everything you wanted, correct?
Very close, very close. There is one provision that we wanted that we did not get in the new law, and that would have required an automatic mandatory suspension for anyone who refuses the breathalyzer, whether or not they are subsequently proven innocent at trial.
Yeah. Well, it may not have that, and that's a story for another day, but it does have other things, Ron. Just tell us, what else does it have?
Well, we have an impoundment where if you are arrested and charged with drunk driving, we will impound the car for 24 hours. We've had cases in the past where people have gotten their car back and gone out on the road and killed somebody.
Mm-hmm. There's a legislation in New Jersey because of just that. People were still drunk when they were released from jail.
That's right. We also have a component in there that is a child endangerment provision. If you have a child under the age of 14 in your car and you are arrested for drunk driving, you will face stiffer penalties. We've actually had people who've picked their children up at daycare and they've been drunk. We have an aggravated drunk component in there that if you are arrested and you blow a .20 on the breathalyzer or above, that's considered aggravated drunk, and you will face even stiffer sanctions. We also have a provision in there for the installation of interlocking devices on the cars of repeat offenders if they subsequently ask for a hardship license.
Ron Bersani, you started this because you're a grandfather who was grieving. Many people who watched you on the Hill here in Boston thought you were a lobbyist. You were so accomplished at what you ended up doing, and you have accomplished quite a bit with this. How are you feeling today?
Well, today is a bittersweet day. It's very difficult because, Robin, it's not easy to wear your heart in your sleeve and tell your story, the worst moments of your life, over and over and over again. But my family has made a commitment to do the best we can. There isn't one of us who would not give our life to bring Melanie back. We can't do that. We're trying to do the next best thing, and that's honor her memory and save another family from going through this agony.
Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Ron Bersani is the force behind tougher drunk driving rules being signed into law here in Massachusetts today. It's called Melanie's Law, after his granddaughter. She was killed by a repeat drunk driver in 2003. You're listening to Here and Now. And this reminder for listeners, we are following Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald's investigation into the outing of the plane case. We are following it on his website, and you can as well. There is a link at our website, here-now.org. At a time when consumers are facing sticker shock at the gas pump, the world's oil companies are reaping record profits. ExxonMobil, the largest in the industry, said it made $10 billion in the third quarter. In the meantime, federal lawmakers say they want to tax big oil and try to bring gas prices down. Well, we're joined on the line now with some insight by Vijay Vaidyaswaran. He's the environmental and energy correspondent for The Economist magazine. Vijay, welcome as always.
Good to be with you.
And Shell, Chevron, Exxon, all reporting these massive profits. Put this in context. How big is a $10 billion in a quarter profit?
Well, these are among the highest corporate profits in history. And this comes from oil companies like Exxon, who right now sits right at the top of the Fortune 500 as the biggest company in on the stock markets, even bigger than Microsoft or GE or some of these other icons of the postmodern age. These old industrial companies are right on top right now because of their profitability and, of course, because of the oil price.
So why are consumers, with that huge profit margin, why are consumers paying also more than ever?
Well, that's actually the most important question now. Why are we paying so much? There's a number of suggestions of price gouging. My view is if there's any price gouging going on, immediately companies should be brought to task and taken, hauled off in chains, as it were. But the hard truth is, the unpleasant truth, is that it's not big oil that is fixing the prices. There's a group that's even more anti-consumer, those of you who look for conspiracies, and that is the OPEC oil cartel. The ministers of Saudi Arabia, Iran, Libya, Venezuela, they meet every 3 months in meetings in Vienna. I frequently attend these meetings of the cartel, and they are the guys that get in the room and decide what oil production should be and have a big influence on what oil prices are set at. Even though Exxon is a big company, it's actually very small compared to the Saudi oil company. The Saudis are 20 times the size of Exxon. Exxon doesn't set the world market price.
Well, so what are companies like Exxon saying about, saying publicly about their profit?
Well, they're obviously very embarrassed to be making so much money when so many Americans are suffering from the gasoline pump prices. And so they've been trying to soft pedal these results. They point out, for example, that these happen to be good times, but back in the 90s, they were bad times for oil companies. Oil prices collapsed in 1998, 1999, and when oil prices are low or moderate, nobody remembers them. When oil prices really fell to $10 a barrel, which is incredibly low back in 1999, let's bear in mind we touched $70 a barrel in price just a couple of months ago, so prices have gone up 700% on the world market. Yeah. But when prices collapsed, nobody was there applauding them for low prices, or nobody was too concerned about the profitability or lack of profitability back then. So they point out that it's a cyclical business. Prices go up, prices will come down.
Right. And this gives them a little bit of a pad. I've heard officials say, well, Congress nonetheless is putting pressure on the industry to tame prices, and even talk of a windfall tax. How viable is that?
Well, I think politically it could be quite viable. There's a lot of anger and resentment across America as Americans are spending more and more of their disposable income on energy costs, not only gasoline, of course. We're going to see a terrible winter in terms of natural gas heating costs. They could go up 50% or more if it's a bad winter for people who happen to heat their homes with natural gas. And so that's a double whammy in terms of energy costs. So I think there's a lot of political support to go and get big oil. And we certainly did that during the last oil shock. And the years right after, there was a windfall profit tax, as it was called, imposed on the oil companies back then. Now, when you ask about viability, we have to ask, is it actually good public policy? Does it make sense Is it going to lead to low prices in the long term and keep prices low? The answer has to be no. Any good economist and who's not affiliated with the oil industry will tell you that this is a fail.
Well, we'll have to.
Prices are up, prices are down.
Well, Vijay, you know we'll have this as an ongoing conversation. We so appreciate you stopping in with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Vijay Vaidyeswaran, environmental and energy correspondent for The Economist. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. American Style magazine voted New Orleans the number one arts destination for mid-sized cities last February. That's up from 17th place last year. Artists from the city say that leap reflects huge strides made by their community in recent years, making New Orleans not just a place for artists to live and work, but a competitive location for showing and selling. That was before Katrina. Now, with many artists displaced around the U.S. and art buying a low priority in Louisiana, the picture is very different. Gallery owner Jonathan Ferrara has closed up shop and leased his space to a roofing contractor for a year to embark upon a tour called Artists in Exile. If the buyers won't come to him, he'll take artwork to them. Reporter Rachel Bonham Carter caught up with him on his way to the annual AAF Contemporary Art Fair in New York City.
All right, so...
Unloading artwork for the AAF Contemporary Art Fair on Manhattan's Upper West Side, New Orleans gallery owner Jonathan Ferrara. With his life turned upside down by the hurricane, this is the first show he'd scheduled before Katrina that he's managed to make.
You want to just put down the tree on the ground someplace?
It's also the first stage in an attempt to salvage normality from amongst the chaos for him and his gallery artists.
The AAF was really kind of like the light at the end of the small tunnel. I mean, the tunnel's really long for all of us that are from New Orleans. It became a natural segue into the Artists in Exile, Gallery in Exile idea that I came up with, that, look, this is taking the show on the road, and we need to do more of this now because we have lost our local art market because people don't have houses. They're not going to be worried about artwork. Quite frankly, the exhibition, would, on our behalf, we would have been much more well-prepared at this point. We're kind of last minute because we've all been getting our lives back together. And when I say lives, not just, you know, we're talking about our physical property, our well-being, our mental health. And, you know, some artists lost their entire studios. The work that I was counting on to bring here, some of it's not even here. When you're living on a survival basis, which I have been for the last month, hour to hour, day to day, you know, planning for the future is something that's a kind of a luxury at this point. So my planning for the show was basically work with the artists that I had in mind, load the truck and drive.
As one of those artists Jonathan had in mind, Miranda Lake returned to New Orleans and her uninsured, flooded studio to make sure she had works to give him. Miranda is an encaustic artist. She paints luminescent images with molten beeswax around collages of old photographs.
Hurricane Katrina brought an unwelcome collaborator into my studio, and I'm usually a fan of her work, but I would say that this time around, Mother Nature made for a lousy artist. I had about a foot and a half of water standing in my studio for probably about 2 weeks, and it created this just dank, humid sweat box for all of my work to be sitting in. I was supposed to have a big show in New Orleans in October, and I had quite a bit of work that was hanging on the walls. And so I kind of had to do triage when I got back there, not even a couple of weeks ago, to see what I could salvage for this opportunity here in New York. And all of this was done without any power or hot water. So I was at my house with none of the creature comforts. Had a generator that was on loan, so when I had that available to me, I was running my hot plate for the encaustics. You have to melt the wax to paint with it. Running my hot plate off of that and my heat gun. And when my contractor needed the generator, I would just take my paintings outside and stick them on the roof of my car and let them fuse in the sun. So it was definitely frontier painting.
There's zero to be recovered, and I'm making art in a hotel right now. That was given by Red Cross.
Dan Tague, artist and curator of Jonathan's last show, is helping hang this one. After spending 7 days on the roof of his studio with 15 other people, he has little desire to return to New Orleans right now. Like Jonathan, he sees the road as the only option. He's curating another touring exhibition for displaced New Orleans artists called No Place Like Home.
A lot of the artists in this show, maybe only three, are actually in New York. And so wherever they want to establish themselves or reestablish themselves, I want them to make it easier. I want them to have this kind of some sort of precedent. So if the more it travels, the more their names get known, the more people see the work, and it easier of a transition will be for them. And it's just encouraging to make work. Like for myself, in a hotel room, just wherever you're at, you got to always be an artist still.
Okay. Miranda, do you have a price list?
I am Ashley Huck. I am the director of the Jonathan Ferrara Gallery in New Orleans. You know, it's very cathartic to be able to create again and to be in this environment, seeing other artists and mingling with the arts community and just practicing your craft. It's very cathartic and therapeutic for everybody involved. So, you know, it's allowing me to work again. It's allowing the artists to work again. It's even just walking by, seeing that we're from New Orleans, people can't believe it, that we're actually here.
The Artists in Exile tour may have left New Orleans for now, but it's only out of a belief that that's the best way of keeping the city's art scene alive until the time comes to return home again.
I've been talking with a gallery called Lambert Gallery in Atlanta. I'm working with trying to do a show in Los Angeles. We're looking for spaces around the country and exhibitions to bring high-quality New Orleans art to the rest of the country, to show them what our creativity is, what our creative culture is, and what our visual arts have been working towards for the last 25 years of kind of growing into a scene of a national standing. We do have a very unique and individual culture, and that culture is reflected in the visual art, in the music, and in the literature, and in the lifestyle. And that's something that hopefully has to live on, and we just want to bring a little taste of that to the rest of the country.
What sort of reaction have you been getting from other artists, gallery owners here while setting up today?
Applause,
yeah,
people cheering.
Woo, New Orleans.
Yeah. You know, and somebody saying, "You're going to sell everything. You're from New Orleans." You know, it's like that'd be great if that was the case. I mean, you know, a lot, and the people from the AAF have been very supportive, and they're glad that we're here. A lot of people, you know, glad that we didn't give up. You know, that we didn't just say, "Oh, it's too much to deal with." That we're here and that we can do, you know, something. It's some semblance of normality to have continued on with our plan.
How does it feel to see all your work here on a wall, just ready for people to come and look at?
I say bring them on. I'm ready.
We
need to move some wax, please, so I can rebuild my studio. It feels great. I'm so proud of all of us for being here and pulling it together. This was not easy.
Reporter Rachel Bonham Carter on Exile New Orleans artists in New York City. You can see slide images from the artist on our website at here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Stay tuned for all the recent news in the Plame investigation. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
'Cause I feel so all alone. Back home to meet my new old mother. That's where I belong. You know, all of my friends, yeah, turn their backs on.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.